Today is December 2nd. We are continuing with creation. We are in Parshas Toldos on pages 126 and 127. We pick up where we left off after Rivka has received that faithful prophecy from Shem, the son of Noah, regarding her two children that she's about to give birth to. So we are up to Pasuk Chaf Dalet 24 on page 126 and 127. And her days were full to give birth, which means she carried full term. And behold, there were twins inside of her. The first one came out red. All of him like a mat of
herring
mantle. Okay. And they called him Esav. And afterwards, Yatza Achiv, his brother, came out, and his hand was holding to the heel of Esav. And he called him Yaakov. Yitzchak was 60 years old when they were born. let's just point out some of the things that Rashi tells us over here. Very clear indications of what is going on. First of all, as I mentioned, she carried full term. That's clear in the pasuk. The first one came out red. Isn't that a funny thing to say? Wouldn't you say the first one came out quickly, slowly? What does red have to do with how it came out? The child doesn't come out red.
They usually come out pronounced.
That's when they're not breathing. When they just come out.
It was unusual. That's what stood out. That was what was noticed. What I mean to say is, red doesn't modify coming out. You don't come out. When the first one came out, you could see that he was red. But the first one came out red means that that's what stood out. That was the thing that caught your eye. He came out red, and he was like a hairy mantle. Vayikru Ushmo Esav, and they called him Esav. So Rashi tells us in the name of Chazal, the name of our sages, that Vayikra'u Shemo Esav, and they called him Esav, means everybody called him Esav. Normally, you don't find the plural for naming names in the Chumash. Either it says Vayikra, and he called, which usually means the father, or Vatikra, and she called, which usually means the mother. In fact, predominantly you find Vatikra, and she called. Most of the time, when the Torah states who named a name, it is the mother who did so. More often than the father, although you do find the father does it at times. But over here, that it's in the plural, that's highly unusual. I would like to say it's the only time, but I don't want to say that because I didn't check. But it's certainly rare that it says, and they called him Esav. And so on this, our sages say that everybody called him Esav, because Esav means made. It comes from the word asui, to be made, complete. Esav appeared physically mature already at birth. He appeared like there was very little growing up to do. He was complete and made when he came out. Then it says, and afterwards, his brother came out, and his hand was holding on the heel of Esav, and he called him Yaakov. So who's he? So the simple meaning is it's Yitzchak who called him Yaakov, but the Medrash says, and Rashi cites it, that Hashem says to Yaakov, to Yitzchak and Rivka, you named your Bechor Esav, you named your firstborn Esav, and I will now name my firstborn Yaakov. And therefore, Vayikra refers to Hashem himself. God named him Yaakov, which means he gave Yitzchak and Rivka the Ruach HaKodesh, the divine inspiration, to call him Yaakov, based on, of course, him holding the heel. And it tells us that Yitzchak was 60 years old when they were born. Why was Yaakov holding the heel of Esav? Remember, Yaakov doesn't have free will. But what is the... Not at that point, anyway. But what is...
It implies he wants the Bechara. He wants to come out first.
So it implies that he's trying to pull him back in order that he should get out. Yaakov is trying to beat him out of the womb in order to be the firstborn. Of course, he didn't make it. And Esav is the biological firstborn. And it's going to take some work for Yaakov to become the firstborn. But already, you see symbolically that Yaakov is after the birthright, on his way out.
Will you have Sandler come out and they put the red string on it?
That's later. That's okay. Tamar's children.
Okay. That's
which is an excellent point. When we get to Tamar's children and we compare that instance to this instance, and there's what to talk about, then we'll discuss that. So keep that thought.
How they could know who is first, who is second? If Hashem wanted to Yaakov to be first, but Esav first?
No, if Hashem wanted, whatever Hashem wanted, it would happen. Esav was first because he was meant to be first.
Yeah.
But it's symbolic that Yaakov attempted to be first. As it showed that it was going to be this constant tug of war. Who's going to be first? Who's going to be the older one? Who's going to be the Bechor?
You said that Hashem gave them Ruach HaKodesh to name him Yaakov. Weren't all the names with Ruach HaKodesh?
Yes, of course. Of course. But here, Chazal is telling us that Hashem is stating that this is my Bechor. I'm going to now take over.
You, more so than the other...
Apparently more so. Apparently Hashem's being involved in the name is more here, not just the Elvis, but the Shvatim also. But apparently over here it's more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm not sure who said it, but I think I heard that they really looked alike. So how could they have been fraternal when they're not the twins?
They looked similar. They didn't look exactly like him. Well, Esav was red, and he came up with a mature body. Yaakov was not that way.
So they couldn't have been fraternal twins.
I suppose not. Rashi says they were not fraternal.
They were identical.
One second. No, I got it mixed up.
Fraternal. But they were not identical.
I thought fraternal was identical.
No.
They are fraternal.
Yes. What is it when
they're
not identical?
They look alike. They don't look alike. The fraternal.
They were fraternal.
They were fraternal.
Or identical?
I'm a fraternal.
So Rashi says they were fraternal. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I have a question.
Yeah.
When you say that Esau was, when he was born, he had the appearance of a fully mature individual. His babies come out, they're tiny. So does it imply that he already had the nature, each hadeh, that this is going to be the way he was throughout his life? That he wasn't going to change? I mean, growing, he would grow, you know, out and up. But is it saying that he never would change? This is the essence of who he was already at birth?
Chazal say that Esav was made, meaning that Esav did not see in himself the need for perfection. As we know as Jews that we emerge from the womb imperfect, and the job of life is to perfect ourselves. That's one way of saying why we're here, which is to work on perfecting ourselves. Another way of saying it is to grow closer to Hashem. They are really the same thing. You perfect yourself by getting closer to Hashem. By getting closer to Hashem, you perfect yourself. That it all goes together. So that is, Yaakov represents that, because Yaakov comes out and he's called Yaakov, which means heel. And later, his name will be changed to Yisrael, which is a more majestic name. It's a name that implies royalty. Yaakov grows throughout his life. Esav is also, he is made. He doesn't change. He doesn't see the need to change.
But also the name Yisrael, anytime you see Yaakov in his most spiritual being, the name Yisrael.
Right. But he needs to grow into that. That's correct. So there is an implication in Esav, symbolically, that he does not need to change he himself. Now, this is all, of course, symbolic. The Esav and Yaakov don't have free will at this point. We know, as because Rivka already got the prophecy that one is going, they're going to be severed from the womb, and we have to see what could have Esav's role been. Esav, as we know in retrospect, ended up being evil, and he, in fact, is our arch enemy throughout the generations. However, that nobody is destined to fail from birth. Hashem, everybody has a chance at something. The question is, what would have been his chance? What could he have done? We know that, as I explained last week, that both Yitzchak and Rivka would have assumed, that they together, Yaakov and Esav, would play a role together, and they would complement each other in the service of Hashem. But Rivka was told prophetically that can't be the case. They're going to be totally and completely separate from birth. So where does that leave Esav in the grand scheme of things? That's what we have to explore. And that's something which we'll as we go through the parasha, we'll have to understand better. But this is this is, they were clearly different from birth. One was fully mature, or at least physically mature, one was not. Let's move on a few more for a second. We have a lot to discuss here, but let's cover a little more ground first. Starting from Chav Zayin 27. Vayigdilu ha-ne'arim, the lads grew up, which means they turned 13. This is the first 13 years of their life. Rashi says during the first 13 years, you really couldn't tell much difference between them. They, all children, some of them are a little more hyperactive, some of them are a little more shy. They were essentially doing the same kind of thing for the first 13 years. But after that, then you already could tell who was who. Vayhi Esav Ishyo De'atzayin Ish Sadeh. Esav was a man who knew how to hunt, a man of the field. V'Yaakov Ish Tam. Yaakov was a simple man, Yoshev Ohalim, dwelling in tents. Esav being a man who knew how to hunt, a man of the field, that is exactly what it implies. He was a person who used to go out into the field. Remember, in those days, you didn't have computers or internet or text messaging or anything else for the teenagers to get involved with. What did he do? He went on the field and he hunted. That's what you did. You needed recreation. You went and you hunted animals. That's what Esav learned how to do, and he was very adept at it. Yaakov was not involved in any of that kind of thing. He was more simple, and he dwelt in tents. And Chazal tells Rashi says, the tents of Shem and Aver. He dwelled in the tents of learning, meaning the Ahalo Shal Shem and Ahalo Shal Aver, the Yeshiva of Shem and the Yeshiva of Aver, which were the two institutions of higher learning that existed at that time, were Shem and Aver. And that's where Yaakov hung out. That's where he stayed. Vayahav Yitzchak es Esav kitzayid b'siv. Yitzchak loved Esav for his sayid, which means his hunting was in his mouth. The Rivka Ohavas as Yaakov, and Rivka loved Yaakov. Now, this is a very, very important verse. And let's understand this verse against the backdrop of last week's discussion. Vayahav Yitzchak as Esav ki Tzayid b'fiv. Yitzchak loved Esav. Why? Because Tzayid b'fiv, which literally means the hunting of Esav was in Yitzchak's mouth, which means Esav would hunt, and he would capture animals. He would then serve them to his father Yitzchak. And therefore Yitzchak loved Esav. Right? Give him a nice steak every night. Rivka, and he lives to be 180 years old. Rivka loved Yaakov. Now, you tell me the answer to this question. Isn't it striking that the Torah gives us a reason why Yitzchak loved Esav, but does not give us a reason why Rivka loved Yaakov? Says Yitzchak loved Esav because his hunting was in his mouth, and Rivka loved Yaakov. Why?
When they were born, and you say Esav was already born and Yaakov was still, then Rivka had to nurture Yaakov more.
Okay.
Because he wasn't born. He was still in need of a mother to take care of him. And so maybe she felt closer
bond.
Him.
Okay.
She bonded closer
Okay.
Maybe because we are going to know that Esau was not a good person, so we would need a reason why Yitzhak would love someone for
Yaakov
reason,
would be
but Rivka loved Yaakov unconditionally, so there weren't any reasons for her love because she was a loving mother.
Okay. What are you going to say?
We already know the prophecy.
Okay, we already know the prophecy. Uh-huh. Rivka has the knowledge of the prophecy. Rivka already is predisposed to knowing that Yaakov is the main one of the two. V'rav Yavod Sayir, the older one, is going to serve the younger one. Rivka is aware of this from the beginning. So Rivka has got her eye out for what's going on, and the other reasons are true as well. And she loves Yaakov. The Torah doesn't need to explain it to us. It's much more self-evident why Rivka would love Yaakov. But why would Yitzchak love Esav? Yitzchak was no fool. Why would he love Esav? So the Torah has to explain to us because the hunting was in his mouth. Rashi tells us there's a dual meaning over here. It doesn't only mean that Esav would hunt and feed his father Yitzchak, but in addition, he would hunt him with his mouth, which means Esav would make it appear to Yitzchak that he, Esav, was very righteous. And he would ask him all sorts of questions to make it appear as if he was trying to be scrupulous about the service of Hashem. How does one take miser, take tithes? How do you do this? How do you do that? He would ask his father questions which seemed to be indicative of his interest in being scrupulous in how to serve Hashem, when in fact it was all a facade in order to trick his father into making him think that he was righteous. And so Esav, already at 13 years old, was very crafty. He was crafty. He knew how to hunt someone with words, how to manipulate. Sometimes children can do that at a much younger age than 13. But Esav was doing it on an adult level. And he was doing it at the age of 13, already manipulating his father in this way. Now, let me point something out about this verse, which is, I think, very, very important. Everybody understands this verse. I shouldn't say everybody. The typical way to read this pasuk is, Yitzchak loved Esav more than he loved Yaakov, and Rivka loved Yaakov more than she loved Esav. That's the typical way to read the verse, because it seems to be a contrast. Yitzchak loved Esav, Rivka loved Yaakov. Implication is that the reverse was not true. I don't believe that that is the accurate way to read the pasuk. The first thing the Torah tells us is Yitzchak loved Esav. That is something which is surprising. It's a surprising fact. It's not surprising that Yitzchak loved Yaakov. After all, Yaakov was learning Torah, dwelling in the tents of Shem and Aver, following in the footsteps of his father and his grandfather. Of course Yitzchak loved Yaakov. Why would he not love Yaakov? And there is never any indication anywhere in the rest of the parsha that Yitzchak did not love Yaakov. He loved Yaakov. The Torah is telling us a chidush, a novel thing that we would not have known. The Torah says, I want you to know something. Yitzchak also loved Esav. Yitzchak did love Esav. You would say, but why? Why would he love Esav? Esav was an ish, Yodei Atzayin, Ish Sadeh. He was a hunter. He was a man of the field. He didn't spend his time in spiritual pursuits, in learning Torah and in yeshiva. So why would Yitzchak love him? Torah tells us, no, he did love him, and I'll tell you why. Kitzayid Befiv, which has that dual meaning of Esav attended to his father's physical needs, A, and B, deliberately, and this is crucial, deliberately manipulated his father into thinking that he was righteous. So the Torah is not pointing out that Yitzchak loved Esav more. The reason why everybody thinks that the Torah is saying that he loved Esav more is because later he wants to give the blessings to Esav. So people think, well, that's because he loved him more. It has nothing to do with loving him more. It has to do with Yitzchak's assessment of the situation, thinking that it would be better for Esav to have the blessings, as we will show later why he thought that. And we'll show later why that would be true if he wouldn't have the information that Rivka had about that prophecy. Without the prophecy that Rivka had, just like the knowledge Yitzchak had, then it would be obvious to give the blessings to Esav, as we will show. But it wasn't because he loved him more. And so the Torah is telling us Yitzchak also loved Esav. Don't think his love was only for Yaakov, it was for Esav as well. Why? Because of the hunting.
Why did Rebecca tell us?
Well, good question. Excellent question. Hold on just for a second. Hold that thought. The Torah then says, and Rivka loved Yaakov. Mm-hmm. Now, hear what is the Torah saying. Obviously, Rivka loved Yaakov. Just like the Torah didn't have to tell me that Yitzchak loved Yaakov, right? I just got finished saying, the Torah does not say Yitzchak loved Yaakov, because that's obvious. Of course Yitzchak loved Yaakov. The Torah only has to tell us Yitzchak loved Esav. So then why does it tell us Rivka loved Yaakov? Because here the Torah is contrasting. Now the Torah is saying, but Rivka preferred Yaakov. And in fact, you see this from the words, because the language, the tense of the verb. Excellent. Yeah, go ahead. How do you see it?
So one is present and one is future.
Right. One is the future, but flips to the past because of the
vav.
Right. Excellent. Very good. Very good. Excellent. Okay, we have a diktok expert. Excellent.
There's two ways of loving.
Well, hold on. We'll get to that in a moment. But Yitzchak, it says he loved Esav, and it says, and Rivka loves Yaakov. It doesn't say she loved Yaakov, but Rivka loves Yaakov, because that doesn't change. Rivka's love for Yaakov endures. It was then, it is now, it is continuous. That never changes. Rivka has reason from the beginning and on to love Yaakov more, because she knows that Yaakov is really the main heir to the legacy of Abraham and Yitzchak. What do you want to say about the different ways of loving?
Love is conditional. He loved what he could do for him, and the other is totally unconditional.
That's correct. That is correct. Yes?
How did Rivka know which was which?
Because she knew that
she knew one was going to be...
She knew the older would serve the younger.
Oh, is that...
That was the very last... Yeah, that was the very last words of the prophecy.
The older would serve the younger.
Right.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Do you think the reason Rivka loved Yaakov more was because of the prophecy or because she saw how they were growing up?
Well, I think both together. I think once she had the prophecy, then she was predisposed to watch for it.
Right.
It's also harder to trick your mother than it is to trick your father. And that's usually true with daughters. And now with sons, daughters are very good at wrapping their fathers around their finger. And, sons it's not the same thing. But essentially, the Esav was not out to get Rivka, to trick Rivka. Whether he could or couldn't is an open question. It could be he couldn't have done it because she's the mother and the mother would understand better. And anyway, she had the prophecy. She had the knowledge of the prophecy. But more so, as we will show, Esav had a vested interest in cultivating Yitzchak, as we will see. This is already at 13 years old. Esav is focused on manipulating and cultivating his father. His mother, not so, that's, whatever it is, it is. But his father, in his mind, this is a crucial thing that he cultivates his father. Yeah.
But he's firstborn, so isn't he entitled to the
illusion? Yeah. So we're going to get to that.
Why did he have to cultivate? Maybe it was just his personality.
Just missing person. No, but
what I'm saying is, his nature was to go out and hunt and take care of it, and he was a good son. He took care of his father. So why do we have to say that he was manipulative?
So wait until we see the blessings. That's what we're going to show. It's all going to come together at that point. But you're right. At this point, there's no reason to say it. You're right.
Did the Torah give us, because of the situation of Esau, to prepare us also that the evil people, there is chicanery and trickery, because you see that they were loving and Yaakov?
There's no question that the Torah does is
because it has an emphasis on showing
the
evil nature of someone who's not right.
The Torah certainly is preparing us for evil. There's no question. Whenever we encounter an evil person, but there's so much more depth over here. That's not the only thing that's going on. But it is true, once we do encounter an evil person, the Torah does prepare us for how to deal with it. But no. Mr. Jeter really asked the all-important question of this whole parsha, which is, why didn't Rivka share the prophecy with her husband Yitzchak? That's a very, very important question. Now, the answer is not going to answer your question. The answer is because she wasn't told to. And as I mentioned last week, prophecy is specific. The prophecy is not something that you get to write in the paper. Prophecy is something that when you get it, it comes with instructions. The instructions could be, announce it to the world. The instructions could be, keep it to yourself. The instructions could be, share it with your neighbor and nobody else. Every prophecy has its own set of instructions. The instructions here were that Rivka was not to share it. It wasn't said to her. The prophecy was said to shame to tell her. It wasn't said to tell to Yitzchak. And so she was not allowed, she was expected to keep it to herself. Now the question, it begs the question, so why did Hashem do that? Why would he set up a situation where the mother is aware of these facts and the father is not? And the answer to that question is because Hashem wants the events to transpire as they do in this week's, in the parsha, as we will show. Everything happens because Rivka knows the prophecy, Yitzchak does not. It all hinges on that. And that's what Hashem wants in order to create the situation which we're going to have later on.
You're saying Hashem wants a situation where the husband and the wife are not together?
In this case, that's right. It's never healthy to do that. But in this case, that's what Hashem wants. We'll show why.
Isn't that an argument for predestination?
What's that?
Isn't that an argument for predestination?
It depends what you mean by predestination.
I mean, things are written and it's going to happen that way. There's nothing much you can do.
There's almost everything is predetermined.
Right.
But not whether you choose good or evil.
Right.
The Gemara says, Hakol bidei shamayim, everything is in the hands of heaven. Chutz miyira shamayim, except for the fear of heaven.
But he knew, I'm trying to read Hashem's mind, but he planned... For Esau to be evil.
No. He planned for Yitzchak to misunderstand what was going on because he did not have the prophecy. Mm-hmm. And he planned for Rivka not to misunderstand. Now, in the end, because Esau is evil, it plays out one way. Mm-hmm. How would it have played out? Had Esau not been evil, that's something which we'll have to explore. I don't know if we'll be able to answer that question 100% because it's a what if. But we're going to try to explore that question. But we have to understand what actually happened, and then we can try to go back and figure out what might have happened. So this is all at age 13. This is what happens. And then we have the Torah relates to us. So far it's been a narrative about their birth and very general information about them and how their parents related to them. But now we have a very specific incident in their lives, which happens 2 years later at age 15. Vayazed Yaakov Nazid, Yaakov cooked a cooking. He cooked a cooking, which means he made a lentil soup. Vayavo Esav mina sadeh, and Esav came from the field. Vehu ayef, and he was tired. And this is a striking verse. That Esav came from the field is not striking. We already said Esav was a man of the field, but that he came and he was tired is hard to understand. That the Torah is just waiting for us to ask the question. Well, why was he tired? This is not like a new thing for him. He's been doing this for a few years already. He's a man of the field. So why is he all of a sudden tired now? But he's tired. Vayomer Esav al Yaakov, and Esav says to Yaakov, Ha'iteini na. I will say the word feed me, but that's not a good, how do they translate it here?
Pour
into me. The word hal'ata is the same word that you use for force feeding an animal. Mm. If you have an animal, and the animal is not eating, so what you do is you take food and you put it down their throats to the place where they can no longer spit it out and force them to swallow it. That's what hal'ata is. That's the image the Torah is conjuring up over here. Esav says, force it down my throat. Ha'iteinina min ha'adom ha'adom hazeh. From this red thing. Ki ayef anochi, for I am, they translate better than I said, exhausted. Al-kein karashmo Edom. The Torah interjects. Therefore, his name was called Edom. Because he said this, therefore his name was called Edom. And now, Yaakov seizes the opportunity. Vayomer Yaakov said, Michrach hayom es bechoras chali, sell to me as sure as this day your birthright to me. Vayomer Esav, and Esav said, Hinei anochi holech lamos, behold, I'm going to die. V'lamaz ali bechora, what do I need the birthright for? Vayomer Yaakov said, Hishav ali kayom, swear to me like this day, as sure as the day. Vayishav alo, and Esav swore to him. And he sold his birthright to Yaakov. Yaakov nasan la'esav, and Yaakov gave to Esav lechem bread unezid adashim and a cooked lentils. The word nazid really means just a cooked item, and it was made of lentils. Vayochal vayesh, and he ate and he drank. Vayokam vayilach, and he got up and he left. Vayivez Esav es habechoran. Torah testifies for us, and Esav degraded the birthright. Esav, what's the word they use here? Spurned the birthright. Vayivez means to degrade or to put down the birthright. He treated it with disdain. What was Yaakov cooking? The Torah begins this narrative with Yaakov cooking. That means the Torah is telling us that Yaakov cooking was not it wasn't something that was incidental. It wasn't that we should have written a story that Esav came from the field exhausted and about to die. And he walked into the kitchen and he said to himself, oh, thank God, my brother Yaakov is cooking. I'm starving. I'm about to die. Yaakov, feed me. And Yaakov says, oh, Esav, if you want food, I want something from you. I would like the birthright. And Esav says, oh, Yaakov, come on. This is not fair. I'm about to die. And Yaakov says, well, if you don't want to sell the birthright, that's soup for you. And Esav is forced into selling the birthright, and the rest goes on from there. But that's not the way the Torah presents the story. The Torah begins the story with Yaakov is cooking this cooked item, this lentil soup, which means that is the incident that begins the whole sequence of events. So why is Yaakov cooking this soup? Okay, so...
Why isn't Rivka cooking it?
And why isn't Rivka cooking it?
Maybe she's comforting her husband. It was her father-in-law.
Well, we have, let's first explain it. It's a good question. Let's first explain it. The Chazal tell us that Avraham died on this day. Avraham died, which means Yitzchak is now sitting Shiva. And so, if he's sitting Shiva for the Sudat Havara for the first meal, other people have to serve the meal to the Avel. When a person sits Shiva, it is not just a nice gesture that we send meals to people who are sitting Shiva, but the first meal, the Sudat Havara, the rule is that they're not supposed to eat of their own. They're supposed to be fed by others for the first meal after following the burial of their loved one. And so, Yitzchak buries his father Avraham, and now he needs to be fed. So Yaakov cooks this lentil soup for his father Yitzchak. Why lentil soup? And this is how we know. Because lentils are round. And you're supposed to serve something round for two reasons, like eggs or lentils, something like that, something round. And the reason, for two reasons, the Gemara tells us two reasons. One is because something round has no opening, it has no mouth, it's just completely round, and that is to indicate that the Avel does not speak, meaning that he doesn't speak except if he like you're not supposed to talk to someone who is sitting Shiva. When we go to visit and pay a Shiva call, you're really not supposed to initiate conversation. You're supposed to allow the Avel to talk. If they don't want to talk, you simply sit with them and just keep them company, and that's enough. The pasuk says, the verse tells us in Eov, in Job, that when all the terrible things happen to him, after the prophet tells us all of the terrible things that befell him, and how he went from having everything to having nothing, and his three friends came to comfort him, and he was sitting on the floor in ashes and with his garments rent, having rent his garments, and he's just completely decimated from what has happened, and he's there. The three friends come and they sit with him, and they don't speak. He doesn't speak, and they don't speak. He doesn't speak because he doesn't feel like speaking. They don't speak because he didn't speak first. So they're quiet. For how long?
Until he speaks.
How long was that? 7 days. 7 days they sat with him and nobody said a word for 7 days. And it says at the end of 7 days, Eov opened his mouth and cursed the day he was born. And then it went on from there. And then the three of them talk to try to comfort him, and it goes on, and then Hashem speaks in the end. And that's where the book of Eov, that's how it goes on. But it is instructive for going to pay a Shiva call. Sometimes we go to pay a Shiva call and we feel uncomfortable. We sit down and, you know, who wants to sit without talking? So you feel like the silence and you want to say something, and people say things. And sometimes in order to say something, we say things that are really inappropriate. We talk about things like that are really not relevant to a Shiva home. We'll change the show. We'll focus on things that are trivial, that are meaningless, because we just don't want to be silent. But the truth is, the mitzvah of paying a Shiva call, of being Menachem Avel, is to go and sit with the person, even if it means being totally quiet. Just to be there. Just to be there. Because that's all we're doing. And then the Avel, the person sitting Shiva, will dictate how the conversation should go. If they want to speak about trivial matters, then we speak trivial matters with them. If they want to speak about things that are more in-depth or about the deceased, then we speak about that with them. But that's up to them how they want to direct the conversation. But it's not up to the person visiting to direct the conversation. And that's sometimes when I pay a Shiva call, it troubles me when there's someone there who's visiting who's very loud and doing a lot of the talking and kind of like, you know, involving other people and directing the conversation. It's not the visitor's job to do that. It is the other's job to decide how and to whom they want to speak. And if they want to keep quiet, then that's what we do. We keep quiet with them. That's the Shiva call. So that is the symbol of a round item for the first meal. It has no mouth. It's totally a total circle, no mouth for silence. The other reason for a circle, something circular, for the first meal is to show that avelus, that that sitting shiva, is a galgal hachayzer ba'olam. It's a wheel that turns in the world, meaning it is a circle. It, first of all, it's the circle of life. It goes around. There's birth and there's life and there's death. And also, everybody goes through it. This is part of life. Part of life is that we deal with disease, we deal with death. And after all, what bigger bracha is there than that every child should sit shiva for their parents? Isn't that a bracha? Chas v'shalom, we wouldn't want it to be the opposite. So obviously, that's the way it's supposed to be. The older generation should pass away before the younger generation. That is the way the world is meant to run. Death is not good, but if there is death in the world, that's the way we want it to be, that the older generation passes away before the younger generation. So it is a circle, it's a wheel that turns in the world, and that's the other symbolism of the round item that is served. And so Yaakov is cooking the soup, the lentil soup, for his father. because Yitzchak is sitting shiva for Avraham. Yes?
Is this where we learn the halacha of Avraham? With the round and some round?
This is part of it. This is part of what we learn from. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
How far this goes, who sits shiva? For example, why Yaakov doesn't sit shiva?
Yeah, it's an immediate relative.
Immediate, so grandson is not immediate.
No. Right. It's mm-hmm. of the deceased, mm-hmm. it's the father, mother, sister, brother, son, daughter, and spouse. Uh-huh. Those are the ones that sit shiva. Now, the question was why Yaakov is cooking this soup and not Rivka. It's true Rivka could have done it, but Yaakov has an obligation of kibud av, of honoring his father. And so if his father is sitting shiva, so Yaakov is involved in that mitzvah of kibud av, of honoring his father. More than that, although it is true that a grandson or granddaughter is not obligated to sit shiva, and that's what we just pointed out, but when one's father or mother is sitting shiva, it is appropriate for the child of the one sitting shiva, in other words, the grandchild of the deceased, it is appropriate for that person to show a little bit of covered rosh, a little bit of seriousness. There's a little bit respect because his parents are sitting shiva. If one of his parents is sitting shiva, so then it is incumbent upon the child to be mishtatef, to join in a little bit, not to sit, not the rules of shiva, but to be involved a little bit in some way.
In-laws also closer to her. Rivka also sits shiva for Abraham.
No, because she's a daughter-in-law.
But if there is,
right.
In-laws, daughter-in-law is not.
No. Uh-huh. Only direct.
I see.
Yeah. It should be noted. Well, you know what? I'll get back to that. There's a point I want to make about kibud av, which we'll get to in a moment. I hope we'll get to it tonight. Let's leave that for a moment. This is the event that sets it all in motion. Why is this the event that sets it all? So Yaakov is cooking this soup for Yitzchak, who is sitting shiva, for Avram, who died, and Esav walks in the door exhausted from the field. So we said, why is he exhausted? So we already know, and I've mentioned this before, that Avraham died at age 175. And our sages say, the Medrash says, that Avraham really should have lived to be 180 like his son Yitzchak. But he died at 175. He died 5 years prematurely. Why? Because the Hashem told Avram in the Bris Ben Abasarim, in the covenant between the halves, that Avraham would die at a good old age, which meant that he would not see his children or grandchildren be evil, which means when he would die, they'd all be righteous. That even Yishmael did teshuvah, he repented before Avraham's death. And Avraham would die without seeing any of his descendants become evil. So Esav, who is Avraham's grandson, we know became evil. Avraham could not live to see Esav's evil. Therefore, Avraham had to die 5 years early, because when Avraham was 175, Esav and Yaakov were 15. And at 15, Esav committed his first real crime. And that was the crime of murder. Esav murdered his first victim, and he killed Nimrod at age 15. That's what he did. He murdered at age 15. And this was the exhaustion that he comes in from, because it is at this point that Esav has usurped the position of the of evil in the world. Remember, going back to the Tower of Babel, Nimrod was the arch enemy of Avraham, and he is the representation of evil in the world. He's the one who threw Avraham into the furnace for destroying the idols, and we said that Esav eventually will usurp Nimrod. When Esav does that, it is a terrible battle. It is not like Esav normally had the relatively easy battles of hunting and killing all types of wild beasts. Killing a lion was child's play compared to killing Nimrod. And so Esav, I believe it happened at this point, I have to double check whether it was Nimrod or not, but at any rate, it was the murder of a human being that Esav was exhausted from. And here he comes in exhausted. And that's why they're related. Because Yaakov is serving the soup to his father Yitzchak, because Yitzchak is saying Shiva for Avraham, that is why finally Esav was able to murder. Or, as you could say the other way around, Esav murdering is why Avraham had to die at this point. And so, he is ready with his soup. Esav comes in exhausted. And Esav is really exhausted. When he says, I'm about to die, he's not. It's not like, you know, my children are starving. It's not like that. He was really about to die. Esav was literally starving. He was totally and completely exhausted. Now, Esav was a powerful, powerful man. Yaakov was also a powerful, powerful man. They were both very powerful people. We know from indications later in the Torah that Yaakov was an extremely strong person, as was Esav. In fact, by the way, you tell me, how do we know Yaakov is a strong man? When he lifted the rock off the well, as we'll get to in Parashas Vayetze, that was not a miracle. Yaakov was a very powerful man. He was as strong as many men. Esav, we know, was a powerful man because of who he was. Later on, when Rivka is concerned that now Esav hates Yaakov and then they're going to get into a war with each other, her concern is Esav will attack Yaakov and Yaakov will kill Esav. She's concerned that Yaakov will win a hand-to-hand combat with Esav and kill him. So Yaakov was also extremely powerful. We're not talking about weaklings over here. They were both very, very powerful people. Esav here was exhausted despite how powerful he was. So he really had a day of exertion. He really worked very hard over here with his first sin of murder.
Yeah. And he wouldn't have been so bad if he had murdered me.
What she's afraid of is that Esav will try to kill Yaakov. Yaakov will kill Esav. And then Esav's son will avenge his father's death and kill Yaakov. The question is, why did she think that would happen? But that, we'll get to that when we get to the end of the parsha. Yeah.
Now, Nimrod was an evil man.
Yes.
A lot of times when you kill an evil person...
Yeah, that should be like a mystery.
That's right. But it depends on your motive.
Well,
depends on your motive.
Was he killing Nimrod to
what was his motive? His motive was to take over. He wanted... Right. He wanted... I mean, the simple read is in is he wanted the garments that Nimrod had. Nimrod had special garments, which we'll talk about when we get later on. Those garments, which Rivka clothes her son Yaakov in, those are the garments that Esav got from Nimrod. And Esav wanted those garments. And where those garments came from...
Adam.
They go all the way back to Adam, as we'll show.
All this is smoke coming from the world.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
So why do we need to know about the very red stuff?
Okay, good. That's okay, that's where we're going to now. So, Esav comes in, he's exhausted, and he says to Yaakov, pour it down my throat. Stuff it down my throat. From this red thing. Now, what is he saying with this red thing? For I am exhausted. Therefore, he was called red. Now, I would have called him red because he was born red. We said before, he came out red. But that wasn't why he was called red. Yes, he came out red.
Red twice.
Associated with red was blood
red
and murder.
Okay. Red is the association of blood and murder. And that's what's happening over here as well. Esav does not miss the incredible coincidence that he has just committed murder, he has just spilled blood, and he walks in exhausted, he needs food now, and Yaakov, lo and behold, is cooking something which is very red, symbolic of the blood that he just spilled. And he says to Yaakov, pour down my throat from this red, red thing. Almost like drinking the blood of, right, gross, right? But it's almost like that conceptually. Esav doesn't miss that point. And he walks and says, feed me this red, red thing. And therefore his name was called Red. And it is not coincidental. He spilled blood. He comes in and he drinks the red thing to save himself. Had he not drunk this red, red thing, he would have died of exhaustion. And so he would have murdered and he would have died. But this red, red thing saves him from death after he himself murdered. And so he is called Red.
To whom does this karat refer?
What's that?
To whom does this karat
refer? This one does not refer to anybody. It sounds like the people called him Red, but I don't. That's a good question. It just sounds like he was known then from then on as Red.
So it's a little bit like the opposite of Yaakov becoming Israel and Esau going down and being called.
Very good. Very good. Excellent. Excellent. Now, did Esau have a natural tendency for murder? And the answer is yes, he did. That's why he was Red in the first place. That was a symbolic of his tendency for murder. The Gemara tells us people are born with different tendencies, that we know. The Gemara uses the example of a person who has a tendency for murder. And the Gemara says, well, what do you do with such a person? I mean, you just lock him up?
Okay.
So the Gemara says he should be a shaykhin. He should be a person who slaughters animals. That's how he should direct the God-given nature that he has to spill blood. Now, I don't want to say this with a doctor in the room, but you know, I'm queasy around blood. Doctors are not. I don't know what it means. You know, the person who is a doctor, I wonder if that is an acceptable way. It's a funny thing, right? Because spilling blood is usually meant to kill. Doctors don't kill, they do the opposite. They save people's lives. But I wonder if it's still the same tendency. It's not being bothered by blood. That's something, or by these sorts
the
of things.
The choice you make with it.
Right, right. So just because a person has a tendency towards spilling blood, that doesn't have to mean they're a murderer. It could turn them into a murderer. Doesn't have to be. The person could be a shaykhet. A person could be a surgeon. It's also a way of spilling blood, but spilling blood in a positive way, in a constructive way, instead of in a destructive way. So I don't mean to suggest that every doctor is like that. I'm just saying that we don't know, just because a person has a tendency towards something, that doesn't mean they have to be evil. It just means that they have that they're drawn to it. Now, yes?
I want to make a comment. I think it's also interesting that it mentioned that Yaakov was cooking. It's not just to refer to how Rabbi was cooking, but I think it's the contest Esav. And Esav will go to the field and prepare food for the father and never keep it up. But you see that he used it for wrong purposes, for trickery. But Yaakov also cooks for the father.
Okay.
But
okay.
It was good.
So you brought me back to the point of kibud of honoring their father. Esav is known as a person who excelled in the midst of kibud of honoring his father, which really was tayid b'fiv, as we've mentioned before. But Esav was really very, very scrupulous about kibud of. We may talk about this more in depth at a later class. Depends if we'll see how it works out. Just one moment. And that is what he's known for. Yaakov here is the one who is performing kibud of. That's what he's doing over here. At this crucial juncture where the birthright exchanges from Esav to Yaakov, Yaakov is in fact performing the mitzvah of kibud av. Which means, I know you have a question. Let me just finish the thought over here. Abraham dies because Esav sins. Until Esav sinned, Esav was the Bechor. He had the birthright. Let's ignore the prophecy for a moment of Rivka, where we know this is going to happen, but without the prophecy of Rivka. You have two sons. we're assuming, without the prophecy of Rivka, the two of them will work together as the legacy of Avraham and then of Yitzchak. That together, Yaakov and Esav are the legacy. They're the heir to that legacy, together. Who is the main component of that legacy? Esav. He's the firstborn. Without the prophecy, Esav is the firstborn. He's the natural main component of the legacy. He sins. Avraham dies because he can't see Esav's sin. Yitzchak is sitting Shiva. And at that moment, on that very day, the birthright is exchanged. It all happens on the same day. Avraham dies, which implies a certain passing of the torch, although it goes to Yitzchak, but there's change going on over here. Avraham has died. The one who started the whole thing has died. Why did he die? Because Esav is going to sin. He can't see him sin. That very sin forces Esav to lose the birthright. He forces him physically because he's exhausted. He comes in and needs the food. But it's also divine. It's also divine because he can't have it anymore. Because once he sins, he loses the right to be the main heir to that legacy. And so here, Esav is forced into a situation where he's going to sell the birthright to Yaakov. I do want to finish a little bit further. I know there were a couple of questions over here.
Because Esav killed Nimrod, that Avraham died.
Maybe it's Esav that started the process. Yeah, it's because he's going to murder, right?
He's going to murder Abraham.
He would have lived five more years.
We say that Esav was the epitome of doing the missing kibbutz, and yet he did.
Yeah.
But we said he used to lie to his father and ask.
That's not necessarily a lack of kibbutz. Kibbutz means waiting on his father. He served his father.
The trickery and lying to his father?
Yeah, well, his trickery was only to show his father that he was righteous. But did he actually serve his father? Meaning, did he feed him? Did he clothe him? Did he bathe him? Did he take care of all his needs? He did. Mm-hmm. He did all those things. And did he do it scrupulously? And did he do it with attention to every detail? Yes, he did. He did it for a reason, but he did. It was for ulterior motives, but he did.
And again, he didn't know why Abraham died 5 years earlier.
That's right. Now, did he know that his son had sinned? This particular sin, I don't know if he knew that about that or not. He did know that Esav was not perfect. But then we'll see later as we go along.
You mean that he killed?
I don't know if he knew that. I don't know if he knew or not. I don't know if he knew or didn't know. Yaakov says, "Sell me your birthright." So Esav says, "I'm going to die. Why do I need the birthright?
Why didn't you let him die?
Okay."
And he's God, he was going to die with his will from you.
You mean you just spiritual death? He was about to die, physically die from this battle.
He was going
to
die. Yeah. That's only a simple meaning. There's a deeper meaning here, but that's a simple meaning. Yaakov says, "Swear to me today," and he swore to him, and he sold the birthright to Yaakov. Yaakov gave to Esav bread and lentil soup, and Esav ate and drank, and got up and left, and he spurned the birthright. Where do you see that Esav spurned the birthright? I mean, he was about to die. Question one. Question two. What was the deal? The deal was the birthright for?
Lentil soup.
And what does Yaakov give Esav?
Bread.
Where does bread come from?
Bread like
quite a bit. Okay, that's true. That's true. But let's keep it on a simple meaning. Where did the bread come from?
Yeah,
I mean bread. The deal wasn't for bread.
It goes with stew.
Right. So one of my rebbeim, Rav Kolevsky, Zechar Bracha, blessed memory, used to say in Parshas Tolos that had Yaakov given Esav the soup directly, Esav could have then drank the soup and then said to Yaakov, the deal's off. And Yaakov could have said, what do you mean? You sold me your birthright. And Esav would say, no, I didn't, because I was about to die. And so I lied to you. I wasn't exchanging anything. I needed the soup. And so I made it up. I'm allowed to spare my life to keep you from taking advantage of me. So yeah, we made a deal for the birthright. I'm not bound by it because I had to spare my life. Yaakov was aware of this. And so Yaakov gave him bread first. First he gave him bread so that he would not be about to die. And now that Esav was able to live, if he would drink the soup, then he would forfeit the birthright because then it would be a fair exchange. And yet, even after he had bread, Esav drank the soup. And that's why the Torah concludes, Vayivez Esav et habechora. Esav spurned the birthright. Because when he finally did drink the soup, he could have not done so, because he was fully able to survive at that point. It was only because he didn't care about the birthright that at this point he drinks the soup.
So Yaakov gave him an opportunity.
Yaakov gave him an opportunity because it wouldn't have been, it would not have been binding. Yaakov wanted it to be binding.
So I don't understand. I'm sorry. So if he had taken the soup first, then he could have said, you know, no, I was dying. So the fact that he ate the bread, that he wasn't dying, and then he ate the soup, so that was the cincher.
That's right.
So
why would
that's
it not be binding?
Because when a person is about to die, they can make up whatever deals they want and not be held accountable. Because it's in order to save his life. So they're not considered to be not of sound mind. What's the word? It's not the contract is considered to be
null
and void because why? What's the word for? Because it's under duress.
Under duress.
Right.
Oh, okay.
That's it. Yeah. Okay.
So when he finally eats the lentils, he's very conscious.
Right. At that point, he knows what he's doing. And not just knows what he's doing. He could avoid it. He doesn't have to drink it. So at that point, that he's spurning the birthright. This is where we're going to stop for tonight. At this point, we have set the stage for what's going to happen later with the blessings. From here on in, we're going to have an episode of Yitzchak going down to the Plishtim, where there's a famine in the land, and wells, which seems to be an interlude. From here all the way until Perek comes on. The next 35 verses seems to be an interlude, which is seemingly out of place. Seemingly it's a break in the story. We're going to show, after we understand what goes on in the next 35 verses, that it is in fact very, very appropriate to have it over here. That's going to be, but it's going to be a little bit of a break from what we're doing, and then we'll come back to the blessings. And before the shut this